Okay, friends, here we are. This is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 106. And we are on page 370, and we are beginning the chapter on Taurus the Bull. This is the 12th sign, but only if we go in counterclockwise order, or clockwise order. Pisces is the last sign in the counterclockwise order. We now arrive at the last of the 12 signs which have been we have been considering, and the last of those which affect humanity. Indeed, I think all of the signs of the zodiac affect humanity and every other kingdom as well, including the higher kingdoms. And of course, astrology is universal. Every planet is affected by it in whatever solar system that happens to be. Every star and every constellation are also affected. All stars and constellations are also affected by astrology in a still more universal sense, but we are dealing with the astrology which involves the planets found in our solar system and the local stars and constellations only. It is also the second sign after the reorientation preceding discipleship, and which produces changes and opportunity for the disciple after the reorientation preceding discipleship. Now, this reorientation has been called in esoteric astrology the reversal of the wheel. And it begins in a time long antedating actual discipleship, which can be focused more at the time of the first initiation. But there is the stage of the path of aspiration and the path of probation, both of which precede the stage of actual discipleship, which is beginning to occur more at the time of the first initiation. Sometimes it is said that discipleship occurs a little bit before the first initiation, but that's still in a very probationary phase. Once a person is a true first-degree initiate, he is also a true disciple. There's a certain amount of ambiguity surrounding this subject, depending on which references of Master DK one reads and how one interprets those references. But anyway, there is a reorientation, a reversing of the wheel, which occurs before actual discipleship, before the first initiation. Some have thought that the reversal of the wheel only occurs after the second initiation, and I would say that a final and secure reversal, when a man is no longer considered a liability or a hazard, does occur after the second initiation. But there is a kind of reversal or reorientation which occurs during the fifth petal processes, the stimulation, the organization, the unfoldment, and the opening of the fifth petal. These processes are connected with egocentricity, with aspiration, with probationary discipleship, and also finally with discipleship itself, because when the fifth petal is fully unfolded and work is being done on the mental petals, the seventh and eighth and so forth, then a person is a first degree initiate. But in any case, what's important here is that the reorientation precedes discipleship. So there is definitely something occurring that makes a man an aspirant or a probationary disciple, and this is occurring before the true discipleship. We come to a sign which is called the sign of major life incentive, because Taurus is a symbol of desire in all its phases. Incentive is perhaps to be considered the reason or the objective, the reason for which one does something. One springs into action to fulfill a certain goal or vision or objective. And this goal or vision or objective with its magnetic pull is called the incentive. Now, major life incentive means such an objective or goal which is orienting throughout the life. It shows the major line of desire which an individual will follow. And this, of course, can be from low to high. Taurus is involved in all such desires leading to the fulfillment of that which magnetically draws it forward, leading to the fulfillment of that incentive. Whether the subjective man is impelled by desire, and it can be very low desire in the case of Taurus, very material desire for the concrete objectives in the lower three worlds, or the disciple is driven forth upon the path of return by the urge of aspiration. Remember the highest form of idealistic aspirational idealism is found in Taurus, or whether the initiate is controlled by, let's see what it says here, controlled by the will to cooperate with the plan. This is also Taurian. He is nevertheless being responsive to the most important manifestation of a little known and understood aspect of divinity, to which we give the inadequate name of the will of God. As we study Master DK, we discover that the will of God and the factor of desire are intimately connected. One seems to originate from the center of the being, and the other is a call from an outer source which magnetically attracts the being. So will is far more centralized than desire is. Desire is an outreaching, and will is an imposition of action according to a certain direction which is conceived from within. But they are both intimately related, just as ray 1, the ray of will, and ray 6, the ray of desire particularly, are intimately related. The desire of very high beings can become our will. For them it is still desire. And sometimes the will of very high beings can become our desire. We are impelled and compelled by the greater will, and yet we find we desire what that will compels. He says it's very little understood, and he spends some time in various places of the books, especially here in Esoteric Astrology later in the book, to discuss the factor of will in its higher manifestations. But if we can remember the centrality of will and the tangentiality, if I can call it that, of desire, we will have some greater understanding of these two. Desire can emanate or arise from any within any of the vehicles of the human being, a kind of a magnetic tending towards a certain object without the center of that being being involved. But will arises from the center of being and eventually controls desire. Man does what he does eventually because he wills to do so and not because he desires to do so. So let us go on here. The principle of will is closely related to Taurus. Taurus is a sign much connected to Shambhala. the closest approach to Shambhala that is made by humanity, or at least the most intense approach, occurs during the period of the Vaisak full moon, the Taurus full moon. Vulcan, a major first-ray planet, is the esoteric and hierarchical ruler of Taurus, and is also a planet much connected with Shambhala. So both will and desire have to be studied. The fixed determination of, let us say, a member of the new group of world service is a form of will, but not the highest form of will. And they are also animated by a high form of aspirational idealism connected with desire. So those factors, aspiration, will, aspiration, idealism, are all connected with Taurus. At present, we're told that Taurus brings in constellationally only the fourth ray, but one begins to wonder, as other rays will inevitably work through these different constellations and signs of the zodiac. Just as on Earth we have all the rays, of course, even though the first, second, and third ray are the major rays on our planet, all of them exist. We can expect that a constellational logos, a constellational being, will have its ray of its personality, of its soul, and of its monad. They will not necessarily all be the same ray. I suppose it is possible, maybe in the case of our solar logos, a final, a second-ray monad and a second-ray soul, a final second-ray monad and a second-ray soul are likely, and at the present time we also have a second-ray personality demonstrating through our solar logos. But eventually it will probably be, once the personality is dissolved at the fourth initiation of our solar logos, it will be probably a second-ray soul, that's definite. And what was a fourth-ray, I suspect, minor monadic ray for our solar logos, will give over to a second-ray monad. The personality ray is variable. So when we look at a constellation like Taurus, we're told the fourth ray comes through it, but we can suspect, we don't know whether we're dealing with the personality ray of that constellation logos or the soul ray. It is the ray which is most powerful at this time. We don't know what is the monadic ray. And probably the odds are against the possibility that all three of the major rays of a constellational logos are the same. Of course, there is also the mental factor, emotional factor, and etheric physical factor on those high levels for those high beings. There's a lot of complexity here. We don't, in a way, really need to know this. I guess all we need to know at the present time is the harmony through conflict ray coming through Taurus prominently at this time. But when we look at the actual structure of Taurus or Scorpio, of Aquarius or Gemini, some of those constellations which have only one ray given by the Tibetan, we can consider that time may reveal to us that there are more than simply one ray involved in that demonstration. So maybe, you know, the first ray and the sixth ray are also involved in the Taurian manifestation. When we talk about high aspirational idealism and will, we're not necessarily talking about the fourth ray, which is presently associated with Taurus. Time will tell, and we do not know all yet. Now, we will never know all while we are beings within a universe, or even a universal being, which I think is infinitely removed from absoluteness. So knowing all, I suppose, is a condition which exists when there is no manifested universe. At least I suspect that is the case. Okay, so will, power, desire, aspiration, ambition, motive, purpose, impulse, incentive, plan. DK is going through these various words which can be closely connected. And all of them, I think, can be closely connected to Taurus. All these are words which attempt to express one of the major underlying attributes and fundamental causes, man scarcely knows which, of manifestation, of the evolutionary processes and of the will to be and the will to live. That is a very powerful statement, and I think one that deserves repetition so we can come a little closer to understanding it. Will, power, those are first ray factors, desire, aspiration, sixth ray factors, ambition, it's a first ray factor, fueled by the sixth ray often. Motive, it's associated with desire and with the soul. Purpose, generally a first ray factor, the second aspect of the first ray, I would say. Impulse, this is a moving out from a center, either a first or a sixth ray factor. Incentive, usually connected with desire. Plan, usually found upon the hard line, 1, 3, 5, 7 rays. All these are words which attempt to express one of the major underlying attributes and fundamental causes, man scarcely knows which, of manifestation. Without these factors, that which is intended, the pattern which is to be worked out through form, would not manifest. Of the evolutionary process and of the will to be and of the will to live. I suppose the will to be in form and the will to live in form, that's a special limitation upon the true will to be and the will to live, which can exist in the abstract state. Let's put that down. These last two can exist in the abstract state. The great triplicity of desire, aspiration, and will, and these are progressive, desire being considered the lower of the three, aspiration the mediating aspect, desire reaching towards the state of will, and direction, which is an aspect of will. There is no true will expressed without the sense of direction, are only three words. Notice how he has focused on these particular three. He didn't mention direction earlier, but he did mention desire and aspiration together, and to see direction connected with will, if we're looking for an example of the expression of will in a life, we want to understand whether the life truly has a direction, and is motivated by a vision, an objective, a purpose, a final configuration which the being seeks to see actuated or manifested. And a certain line of progression will move towards the actuation of that, let us call it purpose, and other lines will not, or will be ineffectual with respect to the actuation of that particular configuration or purpose. So the great triplicity of desire, aspiration, and will, and I want to, these are all so connected with the Taurian energy. There's a great mystery here in Taurus, and we are learning something about some very mysterious factors in the last of the signs to be considered. The great triplicity of desire, aspiration, will are only three words, direction, will are only three words which endeavor to describe the progress and bias, the tendency of man, the personality, man, the soul, and man, the channel for spirit or life. And I think we can see which is which. Desire is related to man, the personality. Aspiration is related to man, the soul, and direction or will is related to man who is constitutes himself a channel for spirit or life. Notice here the equation of spirit and life. Sometimes spirit is distinguished, or the spirit, from life. Life is, I suspect we can call it pure being. As pure being as we can possibly find in within the universe, the manifested universe. All three point inadequately to the cause of the threefold expression which underlies all events, all progress, and all happenings in time and space. Well, we do want to remember here the monad is threefold. It has will, wisdom, and activity. The wisdom aspect will be correlated with aspiration, the activity with desire, and, of course, will with direction. But there is always a threefold archetypal originating point of power or being of power, which underlies all manifestation or happenings in time and space. How far we should extend time and space, perhaps farther than we ordinarily think. Sometimes we think that in soul consciousness, the time-space consciousness ceases to exist, but even the planetary logos and presumably logoi beyond that have their own time-space schedules which have to be fulfilled. So even in the consciousness of great beings, a type of realization about time and space exists, and we'll know more when we approach. It was the Buddha who clarified for man the nature of desire and its results, and especially desire considered as related to the personality, because it's desire for the three worlds, for life in the three worlds. This is what the Buddha characterized or clarified for us. He clarified for man the nature of desire as it's oriented towards the three lower worlds and its results with the unhappy effects which desire produces when persistent and unenlightened. Fleeting desires which are dismissed have no great consequence. They can be deflected. They can be warded off. They do not necessarily become part of the pattern of one's life. One can be touched by such fleeting longings, but old longings come again yet die, as we are told of the man who is progressing towards the true illumination. So the unhappy effects which desire produces when persistent and unenlightened, and when it is not aspiration, i.e. desire when it is not transformed into aspiration. I have a lot of these code words that make my typing faster, but sometimes they get in the way. It was the Christ who taught the transmutation of desire into aspiration, which from the expression given to it in the New Testament was the effort of the human will, hitherto animated by or expressed through desire, to conform itself to the will of God. This without understanding, but conformity in perfect trust and with the inner assurance that the will of God must be all that is good, both in the individual and in the whole. Now, very interesting, let us say, it was at the sixth initiation that the Christ acquiesced to the will of God. And that is most interesting because there again we have the blending of the six and the one. One is restored to one's true monadic or will nature at the sixth initiation, upon the sixth plane, counting from below upwards. So again, the correspondence between will and desire. There it was that, at that time it was that the Christ acquiesced without apparently fully understanding what was the will of God, but he acquiesced to it, setting the example for all human beings with his statement, "Not my will, but thine be done." So the true will of our planetary logos was anchored at that time upon our planet within humanity. So, of course, the Buddha was surrounded by many aspiring types, but his teaching for humanity, per se, the Four Noble Truths, taught about the extrication from the usual form of desire, the difficulty into which desire leads, and the method of extrication, the Noble Eightfold Path, bringing true nobility of spirit into expression. The arhats surrounding the Buddha, and indeed he did teach them, he taught, imagine, initiates of the fourth degree. This is why I think that the real Buddha was not Gautama Siddhartha per se, but that, as I've said, offering this analogy, that the real Buddha was to Gautama Siddhartha what the Christ was to the Master Jesus. So who was it that sat under the Bodhi tree? At that time it was the great Buddha himself taking the sixth initiation, as it were, and not Gautama, more likely taking the fourth initiation. As I've said, no one, you know, sort of goes off in the woods to find himself after he's been the head of the spiritual hierarchy for some 2,500 years. If we just think about that, we will realize that, of course, it had to have been the disciplic expression of the Buddha who did that, who went off into the wilderness to find himself. The Buddha, as head of the hierarchy, had long ago found himself, and long ago, and probably became the head of the hierarchy at the time of the death of Krishna. If we think that the usual span of expression for a world teacher, the Bodhisattva, the head of the hierarchy, is 2,500 years, approximately 2,500 years before the time of the one we call the Buddha, Krishna died, approximately 3,000 BC, or how is it done, 3,002 BC, 3,001, something like that. So those figures seem to add up. So naturally the Buddha understood the transmutation of desire into aspiration, but probably this was the teaching more for the arhats who surrounded him, and not so much for humanity, which eventually benefited so much from his teaching. Just millions upon millions benefited from his teaching. Millions upon millions of awakening people who were not necessarily high initiates by any degree, but were seeking the Buddha path to awaken themselves to their spiritual possibilities and extricate themselves from the results of lower desire, from the ensnarements, or the snares, we might say, into which they had wandered through the ill-advised application of lower desire. So it was the Christ who taught the transmutation of desire into aspiration, which, from the expression given to it in the New Testament, was the effort of the human will. So aspiration here is looked at as an effort of the human will. That's interesting. Aspiration seen as an effort of the... If I say HW, what will happen? Oh, that's however. Oh my goodness. Human will, animated, hitherto animated, or expressed through desire. So the will used to be expressed by desire, or what we call the human personal will was expressed through desire. The human personal will was expressed through desire. And this human will now had to conform itself to the will of God. So the human will became a higher type of will. It became human will became a higher type of will through conformity to the will of God as understood. Not necessarily, or you know, even possibly, what the Christ experienced as a becoming sixth-degree initiate in the Garden of Gethsemane, no. But every time we attempt to conform to what we sense as the will of our higher power, we are transforming our personal human will into a higher type of will, a kind of sacrificial will, you might say. A higher type of will, let's call it that, because the will of the soul is sacrificial will. Sacrificial will. And this without understanding. Interesting, there's such a test there. Some people say, well, first I will know and then I will do the will of God, but the way it really works is that he who does the will of God shall know. So sometimes we seek the assurance of knowledge before we're willing to commit ourselves to the doing. It's a very natural human tendency, but oftentimes we are asked simply to do because we know it is the will of God, and then the knowledge follows. So in a way it's a test of faith, isn't it? This without understanding, but conformity in perfect trust, having seen the goodness of God and having experienced the goodness of soul expression, and how faith does lead to a better state of living. This without understanding, but conformity in perfect trust, and with the inner assurance based on faith, which is in a way a kind of vision. It's not blind. True faith isn't. Perfect trust, and with the inner assurance that the will of God must be all that is good, both in the individual and the whole. And of course, there's various gods to which that will must conform. They're all part of one God, naturally, but the one God has so many billions, trillions of expressions in lesser entities who also have their own will. So the both in the individual and in the whole. So the whole in this case, is the planetary logos, because the Christ was not attempting to reconcile his very high soul will to the will of the solar logos. That would come later. But it is the planetary logos who is still the initiator, even up to the seventh initiation, at which time he is fully the initiator, an expression of him. An unnamed expression, an unnamed being, is the initiator at the sixth initiation and Sanat Kumara 3, 4, and 5. He is initiator at 3, 4, and 5. But it's all the planetary logos. So this shows us what acquiescence must occur. The true sign of acquiescence, I suppose, is Pisces, but also in Leo and in Taurus, both signs of powerful will. The mantram, not my will, but thine be done, is applicable. Pisces, the sign of acquiescence, but also acquiescence, only to spell that word, is needed in all the signs, really, but in Taurus and Leo, both signs of self-will, and in Capricorn too. Capricorn being a sign which is proud and which or induces sometimes to proudness and pride in certain types of human beings, and in which humility must be learned. So, okay, moving on. Now, as the Shambhala force is beginning to pour into the world, man is seeking another interpretation of God's will, which will not involve the hitherto blind acquiescence. Now, you know, we have to acquiesce to the will of God in a much greater state of blindness than was necessary for the Christ. He was already a head of the hierarchy ever since approximately 500 B.C. He was fully a soul, fully a triad, an expressing triad. So he did not have blindness. And yet there was more to the will of God, apparently, if we follow what the Tibetan says, that than the Christ could understand. So there was a type of higher faith that the Christ displayed when acquiescing to the will of the planetary logos. We have a much blinder condition in our own lives, and we have to trust. Of course, the trust arises because we have contacted something through faith, which changes our energy condition and brings a certain sense of dim knowing into our consciousness. But it's a type of assurance. Faith leads both to vision and to a type of assurance even before faith is entirely lost in sight. So there's no such thing really as discipleship without faith. But it becomes decreasingly blind or increasingly less blind as we progress. And still, a leap of faith is required. I guess they even caught this in the in that movie with Harrison Ford, searching for the Holy Grail. I forget the name of the movie exactly. But he was being Indiana Jones, of course, and there was a certain point at which, in order to save his father's life, so he was highly motivated, he had to step off a cliff in complete faith that something would sustain him, and indeed it did. He managed his courage and stepped off this cliff, and immediately a path that he could tread appeared beneath him. But that is such a metaphor for what we often have to do, knowing that something is right, but not being quite certain that it will happen, but still having enough of this contact with that something that might happen to give us a sufficient assurance to make that leap of faith. Now, as the Shambhala force is beginning to pour into the world, man is seeking another interpretation of God's will, which will not involve the hitherto blind acquiescence and unavoidable acceptance of the inscrutable dictates of a potent, inescapable providence. Well, this is how man used to look at it. And even today, some groups and the various churches counsel an attitude towards God, let's call it our planetary logos for the time being, which resembles this attitude. They are encouraged to think that God's will is completely inscrutable, and only through blind acquiescence and submission is it possible to submit your will to the will of the Father. One will not know anything about the will of the Father to which one submits. But now maybe that changes a little. D.K. says, but which will produce an understanding, cooperation with the divine plan. For that is, after all, the expression of our planetary logos. The divine plan is conceived by those who attune to the planetary logos. He has a plan which is his creation in line with the purpose of a still greater being, and lesser beings within him work on his purpose and also conceive a plan for the working out of that purpose. So purpose is always higher than plan. I guess that's the point that I want to make. But even the planetary logos has a plan as he attunes to a still higher purpose. And that plan of his is considered, in a way, the purpose to which the lower beings have to ascribe, and they work out a plan to express that planetary logoic purpose. So now, because we are perhaps a more intelligent race than we were some thousands of years ago, we have the possibility of a fuller cooperation with the divine plan and an enlightened fusion of the individual will. Notice an enlightened fusion, not just a fusion through acquiescence, but a fusion through understanding, through some degree of understanding, a fusion through some degree of understanding of the individual will with the great divine will, and this for the greater good of the whole, not just for one's own personal salvation, but always as one is approaching the higher initiatic states for the greater good of the whole, which now can be somewhat conceived by the advancing initiates. So, of present-day humanity, functioning somewhat under Taurus here, the sign of enlightenment, we expect not just an acquiescent fusion with God's will as we had in Pisces, but an enlightened fusion of humanity's will with the divine will. So let's say under Taurus, an enlightened fusion of humanity's will with the divine will. This is what we are working towards. And it is we are transiting from the age of obedience and of faith into the age of true occult obedience and knowledge, the age of Aquarius will be one in which Taurus is also strong, for Aquarius is the sign of the spiritual hierarchy and Taurus the sign of the new group of world servers. So think of that then, an enlightened will, enlightened fusion, and an actual understanding of the direction in which God, the planetary logos, seeks for us to move. For this desirable attitude, notice he plays on the words, you know, because we're dealing with the sign of desire, but also of will. For this desirable attitude, there is worldwide preparation going forward in a simple and unobtrusive manner through the gradual fomentation of the will to good everywhere, even though we may not understand that that is what's being fomented. It is the spreading of the attitude of goodwill which is occurring, but goodwill is an expression of the will to good. Humanity can understand goodwill. It comes from the heart and soul. And perhaps it is not understood that the will to good comes from divine purpose, but if one expresses a goodwill sufficiently, one is in line with this will to good. So there is, at least among the more intelligent and understanding spiritually inclined people, a gradual fomentation of the will to good everywhere and the demand so universally voiced that human conditions be more truly enlightened, more acutely polarized for the benefit of the whole, and more definitely subordinated to the innate divine urge for beauty. There's Taurus again in the fourth ray. Innate divine urge for beauty, synthesis, the first ray, and the free expression of the hidden mystery which is to be found at the heart of all forms. You have to marvel at how Master DK puts his sentences together so synthetically and so inclusively of what he has been discussing, inclusive of what he has been discussing. So, the fomentation of the will to good is underway, and that is going to prepare for an enlightened fusion of the individual disciplic will or humanity's will, and the demand universally voiced, that is, voiced all over the world, that human conditions may be more truly enlightened. So let's look at those words. Enlightened, that's a Taurian word, more acutely polarized for the benefit of the whole. And you know, one thinks here in relation to Taurus of the improvement of material conditions. the materiality to which certain types of Taurians are prone can, on the higher turn of the spiral, be lifted toward a spiritual materiality, a spiritual materialism in which matter is rightly used for the benefit of all. Taurus is an earth sign and is related to the material element, but it can also be suffused with the higher energies, with prana, and there can be a right distribution, accumulation of Taurus and distribution in Aquarius. So the idea of fulfillment of desire and some sort of abundant condition are suggested in Taurus. Also, the life more abundant is very much related to Aquarius and Shambhala. So more acutely polarized for the benefit of the whole, and more definitely subordinated, there's one of those will words, subordinated to the innate divine urge for beauty and synthesis, and this would be the plan would express beauty and synthesis, beauty and synthesis, and the free expression of the hidden mystery which is to be found at the heart of all forms. So looking into the world of form via this earth sign Taurus, we find there's a great beauty and synthesis suggested in the Buddhic centrality of every form. And within every form there is this inner core of Buddhi, Raifor, beauty, Buddhi, beauty, Taurus, all of these are correlated. So form is no longer an obstruction to the expression of the inner beauty, but is a means by which that inner beauty is expressed. So everywhere there will be this more intelligent, more enlightened, more understanding acquiescence to the will of God as expressed in the divine plan, or at least that part of the divine plan which we can understand. It is going forward also through the constant attempt to comprehend and interpret the plan for humanity, as its broad outlines begin to become apparent to the developing intelligence of man. So what's needed is certainly increasing intelligence, increasing intelligence is needed to understand the divine plan, and we are coming into an Aquarian age which will be ruled by one of the rays of intelligence. It will be ruled by the fifth ray. Humanity will have a fifth-ray personality in the age of Aquarius. Had, interestingly enough, a third-ray personality in the age of Pisces. So some under Virgo, some of this growth of intelligence did begin. But a rapid development of the intelligence of man is to be expected within the next 500 years, and I would say especially, at least as I conceive it, during the middle decanate of the age of Aquarius, ruled by the planet of intelligence, which is Mercury. So 720 years or so will be ruled by Mercury. There are overlaps, of course. It's not a cut-and-dried thing, end and beginning. But our intelligence will be increasing during the age of Aquarius, and we have to make sure that, given the fact that we will become scientific magicians, that we use our magic for the purposes of the divine plan, and that would be white magic and not purely mental magic to satisfy lower desires, which is also, unfortunately, a possibility. So the constant attempt to comprehend and interpret the plan for humanity as its broad outlines begin to become apparent. And for all of us, I think we can only say that the broad outlines are becoming apparent. If we want to study the word divine plan or plan in Master DK, we'd probably get a much fuller idea of what that plan might be, but essentially, and in a nutshell, it is the illumination of the mind, the revelation of love, and the evocation of the will. So the three divine aspects have to come into development and fuller expression, and of course the emergence of the fifth kingdom in nature upon our planet. The plan calls for the externalization of the hierarchy and the unification of humanity. It calls for the first initiation of humanity and a general condition of greater enlightenment and peace and sharing. The healing of the body of humanity, which now has in so many areas of excess and dearth. Think in your own body if there were areas completely deprived of vitality and other areas which had a super abundance of vitality leading to congestion. It would be a condition of great imbalance. But because there's going to be a strong Libran quality, along with the age of Aquarius, the balance will be achieved. The brotherhood under Gemini will be achieved. The age of intelligent brotherhood will occur in the third decanate of Aquarius, the last 720 years of that age, and right distribution and a cleansing of the Augean stables, which unenlightened humanity has managed to render really filthy, will be cleansed. So we have so much to look forward to if we can simply get through this difficult time when there are cross currents between the outgoing sixth ray Piscean age, a recrudescence of those energies, and the incoming Aquarian energies. It's kind of a difficult mixture, and there's a rending going on in every part of the world as the contest between those who represent each of these becomes increasingly acute. Whenever you hear the professed desire to go back to when we were, you know we're in a difficult situation. I mean, if Mussolini wanted to go back to the glory of Rome, if for some reason Israel wants to establish a still greater Israel, such as the old kingdom was, if the Nazis wanted to go back to establish the true Teutonic heritage when they were marvelous, splendid beings some 100,000 or 200,000 years ago, if Japan wants to reestablish the age of the samurai, in other words, always hearkening back to a former glory. This is a dangerous, dangerous situation. Presently, we have certain Islamists that want to go back to the reestablishment of the caliphate as they imagined it to be, and the self-grandeur that that would bring to them. All of those are retrogressions and are under the influence of the sixth ray, and they are not under the influence of the progressive Uranian seventh ray, which wants to approximate the archetype more completely. So those who want to go backwards, we call them the reactionaries, and those who want to go forward, we call them the progressives, to be understood in the right context. There is a great contest between them, and I think we have to choose where we will give our energies. The glamour of the glorious past, if I can call it that, which is in the minds of quite a number of human beings, is simply a glamour. And that past was not so glorious, nor can it be reestablished in a rapidly progressing humanity upon a rapidly progressing planet. This all indicates a growing responsiveness on man's part to the incoming Shambhala influence. Is so connected with Taurus, after all. Every time at the Waysak period, we experience that touch of Shambhala, and when the Shambhala impacts occur, let's say 1825, 1975, the year 2000, who knows whether that will happen again in 2025, he didn't say. And sometimes he seems to hint that earlier in the 20th century, there was a Shambhala impact. All of these, I think, are experienced particularly acutely being initiated at the time of the Waysak festival, at the time of the Taurus full moon. This all indicates a growing responsiveness on man's part to the incoming Shambhala influences and the consequent evocation of the will aspect of man's nature. We who are students of Master DK, and we know he's given us a dual curriculum, one of the soul and one of the will, or of the monad, and we are attempting to respond to this evocation of our will nature, which is being impulsed from on high. How we respond to the Shambhala influences? Well, they're all different ways. I mean, the evil group of seven in the Nazi collection of reactionary individuals responded to the Shambhala influence in an inverted manner and without love. We don't want that type of response. We don't want just the triumph of the will. It'll never triumph without love. So this all, humanity's growing responsiveness to the will, it all indicates response to Shambhala. Eventually a triangle has to be created between Shambhala hierarchy and humanity. And so far it is still an incomplete triangle. DK discusses this and how humanity is, in a sense, building its own antikarana toward Shambhala, which will complete the triangle, especially as the hierarchy externalizes and begins to fuse with humanity. This must produce undesirable as well as desirable results because of man's present point of evolution. And we talked about the World War II and the evil groups of the Axis there who were responding to Shambhala, and I suppose especially Hitler's group responding to Shambhala in an undesirable and selfish way, prepared by lives of selfish response, as the Tibetan tells us. This must produce undesirable as well as desirable results on account of man's present point of evolution, which is not sufficiently developed to respond intelligently and lovingly to the Shambhala force, and therefore responsible for much that is taking place in the world today. And when this was written, of course, it was the lead-up to the Second World War. This book was written in the 1930s. I have to consult with my friend Keith Bailey. I think he knows more exactly when the period of years over which this book was written. But I think in the mid-30s, pretty much. The trembling response of humanity. Notice that when the will touches and hits, the form may shake. One thinks of the Uranian conduction of the will and the connection to Uranus of all kinds of tremors, earthquakes and tremors within the structure of humanity and within the human being itself. The trembling response of humanity through the medium of the most enlightened and sensitive people in each country to this influence. It produces a tremor of excitement and stimulation and livingness in those who can respond to it in the right way, and just simply a trembling and a kind of a falling apart to those who are too insufficiently developed to respond in the correct way. The trembling response of humanity through the medium of the most enlightened and sensitive people in each country, those people who are mediating this influence towards the other human beings, to this influence and the corresponding magnetic interplay between the great center at Shambhala and the human center is a steadily growing fact. Remember, we've had two Shambhala impacts since this was written, 1975 and the year 2000. So this is a kind of a larger antikarana. When we build our individual antikarana, we are steadily growing towards Shambhala, or the monad, through the triad to the monad. And humanity is doing the same, however slowly. At least there is a deliberate impact on the part of Shambhala, according to its will, upon humanity, and this is a calculated risk. But DK tells us that the calculation is measured, very measured, by those exquisite mathematicians in Shambhala, so that this power which touches and then withdraws will not touch for too long, lest the trembling become uncontrollable and the integration achieved fall apart. So there is a corresponding magnetic interplay between the great center at Shambhala and the human center, and it's a steadily growing fact, registered and noted by the watching hierarchy. Notice that it's a big experiment going on here. It's a Uranian thing, and as with all fifth ray experiments, one has to watch and see what happens. One may not know exactly. Humanity is always surprising hierarchy. And even the solar angels were told after long after they had stimulated the spark of mind and had implanted really the spark of mind in humanity, they had to watch in the later Lemurian days to see whether their experiment had borne fruit or not. And apparently it did. In the later root races of Lemuria, they saw that their efforts to invest themselves in the constitution of the human being had been warranted. And the hothouse effect that Madame Blavatsky talks about had taken place, and a more rapid culturing of the human being had become possible, and millions of years had been saved. If anybody ever edits this, you know, there'll probably be the need to change a few words here and there, but what I'm trying to do is, in a fairly spontaneous way, get the idea across. So, registered note about the watching hierarchy and making certain changes inevitable and unavoidable. Humanity was not at this in this condition before, was not in this condition of potential growth before, and now is, and so the hierarchy must find new ways of cultivating and approaching humanity. So this augurs well for the future. This augurs well for the future, in spite of temporary misuse of the forces. Well, Master Moria has said, in a disturbing manner, disturbing to some, the worse the better. Well, we've certainly had some of the worse, or at least to our eyes, the worse, clearing the way for the better. Okay, well, now what I'd like to do, it is, it's time for me to put this, prepare for 106B. So this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure 106A, page 373. Let's see if I can get this. Yeah. And going to the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure 106, B. Page 373. Sometimes it's a month, you know, even more between my opportunities to do a spate or a slew of these, and this is my first one after a month, so it takes a little habituation. I have to get the wheels oiled up again and moving. So forgive any flusters and inappropriate statements during the first part, and I'll try to go on with all due deliberate speed. Yes, as a matter of fact, this really should go well. This should be put not where I put it, but right over here, right about here. I think this is a good place to put it. Okay, and then we will go on in just a little while.